Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro knows deserts and riots, uprising and crackdown, the setbacks and the triumphs of the Arab Spring. She was there in Cairo's Tahrir Square as word spread that Mubarak had stepped down. She was there as rebels took over Muammar Gaddafi's compound in Libya. Filed the story just 2 weeks ago, standing next to Colonel Gaddafi's corpse. This hour on Point, NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro and her husband, Times of London Middle East correspondent James Hyder, on reporting the Arab Spring and where that spring stands now. You can join the conversation. Have you listened as Lourdes made her way from protest to battlefront to bunker? What's your question for two reporters who have been in the thick of the Arab Spring? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Here's the sound on October 13th, Morning Edition, NPR's aired Lourdes Garcia-Navarro's story about the battle over Sirte, Muammar Gaddafi's hometown in Libya. Be aware that some people may find the next 40 seconds disturbing.
The sickly sweet smell of death wafts over this area of farmhouses, the scene of raging firefights.
We're on the very front lines of the battle here, and as the rebels have moved forward, they've made gruesome discoveries. Right in front of me is one of the three massacre sites that they've uncovered, and the bodies are swarming with flies. They're bloated with death. But what is really striking here is that they were clearly executed. Many of these men were executed while on their knees. They are face down in the ground with their hands tied behind their backs.
Lourdes Garcia-Navarro, October 13th in Sirte, Libya. She joins me right now in the studio. NPR correspondent covering the Middle East based in Jerusalem. She's former Mexico City and Baghdad bureau chief for NPR. With NPR, the BBC, Voice of America, and the Associated Press, she has reported from all over the world. Lourdes Garcia-Navarro, it's great to have you with us right here in the studio. Thank you.
It's great to be here.
And also with us is her husband, James Hyder, Middle East correspondent for the Times of London. He's reported from the Balkans, Latin America, the U.S., and of course, all his reporting from the Arab world. Is author of The Spiders of Allah, Travels of an Unbeliever on the Front Lines of Holy War. James Hyder, welcome. It's very good to have you with us today.
Thanks for having us.
There's so much we want to learn. Some of it is just about the business of reporting, what we've all just been watching from afar. You're each just sort of a week back from Libya and the region. But take us back to October 13th and what we just heard, Lourdes. You're breathless in there. Were you running? Was it just smelled so bad? Why? Just a curious listener's question. Why were you out of breath on October 13th in Sirte, covering that horrible scene?
I've actually never covered a battle, and I've covered many of them, as you have mentioned, that was so ferocious. I tell my friends, and I obviously haven't said this on air before, but I tell my friends it was almost like covering Grand Theft Auto. There were no rules of engagement. There was chaos and brutality everywhere you turned. I was terrified. You didn't know where the front lines were. In fact, at that particular place where I was, only a few hours later, they had lost that area.
Being the rebels?
The rebels. I was with the rebels. The rebels lost the area and were pushed back. And so, frankly, the circumstances were so harrowing that to stumble across scenes of absolute brutality like that.
Massacre. Of people with their hands bound behind their backs.
Yeah, they were tied with plastic strips and they had their hands tied behind their backs and they were face down. And there were four of those sites. And the rebels were taking me to them sort of breathlessly. We had happened to stumble. We were going to a different area and one of them came in a pickup truck and said, come with us. We found these terrible things. Come with us.
Was it clear who was dead there? Who had killed whom?
What was clear was that we knew, because I'd been covering Sirte for a while, that this was an area that the rebels hadn't been in before. So and the bodies had been there for some time. Just you could tell by their state of decomposition.
Yeah, yeah.
So the supposition was clearly that this had been Gaddafi loyalists. But there was no way at that particular point in time of knowing really the circumstances. We assumed later on, we found out later on that mm-hmm. they were possible prisoners that had been captured.
Prisoners of Gaddafi loyalists?
Prisoners of Gaddafi loyalists.
But you could be sure because of the state of decomposition that this hadn't been done by rebels, or was even that not clear?
In that particular site, mm-hmm. because the rebels hadn't been in control of it before, this is an area that they'd been fighting over, and because the bodies looked like they had been there for some time, the supposition was that this had been Gaddafi loyalists. And that later turned out to be the case. Mm-hmm. In other areas, mm-hmm. there were massacre sites now famously discovered at the hotel that had been under the control of the rebels, and they had executed and committed atrocities as well. So what we saw in a place like Sirte was just atrocities committed on both sides. And what was, I think, incredibly distressing as that battle went on, after being with the rebels for a long time, mm-hmm. covering them, their struggle, mm-hmm. to see them basically turn into that which they had so vehemently fought against, that they were the ones now being accused of committing atrocities.
Before it was all over, those accusations were very loud and clear as well.
Yes, exactly. And we covered that. And it was clear that they were treating people badly, and that they had basically turned into, they were brutalizing the people that they...
Something of the very thing they opposed.
Exactly.
James Hyder, here's a colleague who's also, Lourdes Garcia Navarro, who's also your wife in this situation. What has this been like? Were you all tend to be in tandem in the field here, or would she be out there, you'd be in Jerusalem, you'd be there, she'd be back at home base? Did you know, where's Lourdes this morning? Is she inside the bubble of the rebels' advance, or is she caught outside it in God knows whose hands? How much awareness did you have of one another reporting this whole period?
Quite a lot of the time we were together. And when we were together,
that's handy.
Yeah,
terrifying. But
I mean, there was one example in Cairo during the revolution there, mm-hmm. where we were out on the street in an area, and we just stopped. It seemed quite quiet. We just wanted to talk to people about how they were surviving because mm-hmm. the shops were shut and mm-hmm. Nothing was working. And we stopped and started talking to some people, and this mob formed around us, and we were with a colleague of ours, an Egyptian American. A journalist called Ashraf, and we were surrounded by this mob who started shouting at us and hitting Ashraf.
Surrounding you because you were foreigners,
because
you were press, because they were Mubarak supporters, or did you even know?
Mubarak's state TV had been putting out stories that there were lots of Zionist agents out there who mm-hmm. were trying to subvert the regime and bring chaos to the country. They also thought we might be Al Jazeera correspondents, and they hated Al Jazeera correspondents.
Because it was giving voice to Arab Spring sentiments
exactly,
around the region?
Exactly. So mm-hmm. these were partly Mubarak people, partly just scared mm-hmm. Egyptians mm-hmm. Who started attacking us. And
by attacking, you mean what?
They were hitting Ashraf in the face.
That's attacking.
Lulu actually did a brilliant thing there. She started pretending to cry. And, of course, these men were like, well, we don't know what to do here. So they sort of backed off.
Lulu, as in Lourdes Garcia Navarro,
yes.
were you pretending to cry?
I
or
was
were
actually,
you crying? They were
job.
Hitting your colleague in the face.
Well, I thought, I knew we had to get to the car because basically we had to, I saw the situation deteriorating and I wanted to basically yeah. escape. And so we had to get to the car. And so I thought, if you cry, that might garner some sympathy as a woman, which might allow me to escape. And so that worked in a limited fashion. But then, unfortunately, they chased us and surrounded our vehicle. Yeah.
And so it goes on. At that moment, I've been in situations something like this with colleagues in rough situations abroad, but never with a colleague that I was also my spouse. Are you thinking, is it a love going down in flames?
Are you trying to get us to have a divorce?
But just to wonder what it's like to cover something so intense where your professional lives and your personal commitment are all rolled up in that scene together. When they're attacking that car, they're attacking more than just two reporters in that case.
I have to tell you, I've at the beginning of the Egyptian revolution, James went missing, basically because they had cut off the cell phones. There was no way of contacting him. His office called me because they hadn't been able to contact him, asking me where he was. And mm-hmm. I didn't know what the situation was. I was mm-hmm. absolutely terrified. Mm-hmm. And I think at that point, you are no longer someone's colleague, even though I'm mm-hmm. perfectly aware that he's a capable journalist and has been in many difficult situations. I'm his spouse, and I'm as mm-hmm. concerned about him as any spouse would be, and all that stuff goes out the window. So,
when do you decide whether you're going to report a particular story together or not? Does it all depend on assigning editors back in London and Washington, or are you looking for stories that you can work together? I mean,
we
work
try.
Your own issues together on?
We try. I prefer to work mm-hmm. with James. During Libya, a lot of it I didn't work with him. At the beginning I did, and then later I didn't, and I missed having that company. There is something incredibly comforting about going into something terrifying and knowing that you have someone who's got your back in a real sense. Colleagues have your back, obviously, the people you work with do, but your spouse is really, if anything bad happens, going to protect you.
How does it work in a situation like we heard there in Sirte? The rebels are advancing and they're retreating, and it's Grand Theft Auto kind of chaos, fire from all sides. You don't know who's what. How do you have any idea whether you're within the bubble of their advance, where they have some sense of, I suppose, wanting to protect you because you're reporting their struggle to the world? How do you know? Do you have a minder or somebody?
No. I mean, it depends. You can do it in any number of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I did it in different ways in different battles, to be honest with you.
You have your own car, or
yeah,
you're
absolutely.
There in the back of their truck?
No.
Or?
I mean, I believe very strongly, and I think that was borne out in this particular conflict, that you want to have your own vehicle and you want to be working with people who have your safety in mind, their own safety in mind, and you're not at the whims of the rebels. Ultimately, I am not fighting this war. I am there to report on it.
But it's you and James and some Libyan colleagues as well?
Exactly. Libyan colleagues, a translator, a driver, mm-hmm. And they'll have their own vehicle. And we will be with the rebels, you know, nominally,
yep.
obviously reporting on what's going on in that
right.
battleground, but
right.
not in the back of their pickup trucks driving towards a fight. Other colleagues did do that. I didn't feel that it was either safe or necessary for me to be with people who were shooting at other people.
So you're counting on your own wiles and your Libyan staff support to sort of be looking all around 360 at what's going on, when to move, when to go, when to stay, when to dive further in.
And you have to ask, I mean, what we do is you ask people all the time, where's the fighting now? What's happening? And you can imagine in those kinds of situations, people tell you stuff that's conflicting all the time and wrong, patently wrong.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about reporting the Arab Spring and where the region's historic political upheaval stands now. With us today, NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro, NPR correspondent covering the Middle East, based now in Jerusalem. She was in Baghdad before for NPR in Mexico City. Before that, she has seen a lot, and particularly in this last chapter in the Middle East. With us as well in the studio, her husband, who James Hyder, who also is perhaps not coincidentally entirely Times of London Middle East correspondent, is reported from the Balkans, Latin America, the U.S., author of The Spiders of Allah, Travels of an Unbeliever on the Front Lines of Holy War. Let's turn the tape all the way back to February 10th. This is when Egyptians had come out, the remarkable beginning of this wave of events we've seen right across the region. A long-time powerful ruler of that country, Hosni Mubarak, had refused to step down as president of Egypt, even though we had seen massive demonstrations there. On the 11th of February, he agreed to step down. NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro caught that kind of turn on the fulcrum there in the sense of those in the streets. Here she is.
The air of despondency was dreadful last night. People just felt absolutely that Mubarak had really slapped them in the face yet again. And all day today, they voted with their feet. They came out in huge numbers, the biggest protest we've seen so far, all over the country, young people, old people, just a huge cross-section of society, and it was a peaceful demonstration. They went even to the gates of the presidential palace here, and there was they didn't do anything. They just sat outside chanting for Mubarak to go. And finally, the result is this. And I have to tell you, it is an extraordinary sight tonight. I'm actually, words are failing me. It seems like the entire city is singing, echoing off the buildings and off the Nile.
Like the entire city is singing, echoing off the buildings and the Nile. Lourdes Garcia-Navarro there on February 10th and 11th, I guess this is, when Mubarak has gone. Now, we all saw that, and we know what the excitement is like when the Berlin Wall comes down, or when a terrible regime falls, or when we see upheaval like we saw in Egypt. Is that singing still out there? Is that feeling of tremendous lift and possibilities still in the air as you travel this region today, Lourdes, first you?
No, I think is the...
Simple as that, really?
Well, yes.
It was so high. It was so...
I know. It was an extraordinary moment. I mean, I believe it's one of the most moments that have really impacted me the most in my professional career. And there was such a sense of ebullience and hope. Mm. And I think in Egypt, certainly, and Libya increasingly, we're seeing that those hopes dissipate. I mean, Libya is still at the early stages of this. They only a few months ago took over Tripoli and only recently killed Gaddafi. But yet, the hard work of what comes after this, they're beginning to realize that perhaps toppling these strongmen was the easy part, and what comes next is extremely difficult. And in Egypt, particularly...
looking at the entrenched powers that remain behind after the titular head goes away.
Exactly. And seeing those human rights abuses continue, and wondering how to gather momentum to push it to the next level. I mean, I think you see many of the activists, many of the participants in the Arab Spring there really feel what... How do we move this forward? How do we propel this to where we think it should go?
James Hyder, we sat at this table on the very day that Lourdes, and no doubt you, were reporting this tremendous upheaval and rejoicing in Cairo with very smart, longtime observers of this region, literally of the region, saying in this moment something fundamental has changed in the Arab spirit, soul, politics, outlook. It will never be the same again. It may not be easy, but something fundamental has changed. Does that stand as we sit here today?
Yes. No, definitely. I mean, the politics are going to be messy. It's going to take a long time. You know, these are societies that haven't known any freedom, democracy for decades, if ever. But the key thing that they always say to you is the fear barrier has been broken. And when you look at these countries, how oppressive they were and how terrifying the police were, the army, the fact that the Syrians are now rising up, the Libyans have actually pushed this through to the end. It's a spectacular change. And what they have done is change the narrative. That this is not the status quo that is going to survive forever. And they keep on saying, okay, things are a mess now, but we know how to go back to the streets.
We know how to go back to the streets. Though what they find there, I mean, we've seen in Egypt in recent months, can be pretty tough in the streets as well. The fear factor snapped. Here's the moment, August 23rd, when maybe that began to snap utterly in Libya. Again, Lourdes Garcia Navarro, sorry, James, but she's got all the tape. She's the radio reporter here. Was in Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's compound as rebels took over. In an interview with All Things Considered, Robert Siegel, she described the scene there in that moment on the ground.
I am indeed inside Bab al-Azizia, Gaddafi's stronghold, and the place where ordinary Libyans could never get to. And I can tell you right now that thousands of them are streaming into this compound after it was taken earlier today. The scenes of celebration are absolutely incredible. Also, a real sense of chaos. Many of the people here have gone in and are looting a very large weapons storage facility that they found, and they're carrying anything they can get their hands on. So it's a real scene of chaos, but jubilation. People are just ecstatic. They say that they feel this is really the end of the war. This is where they wanted to get to. These past 6 months, the symbol of his power, and now they feel that even though they haven't captured him, they don't know where he is effectively defeated.
And is there any resistance to them at all from inside the compound, or do they have the free run of the place now?
They have the free run of the place. I mean, I can't even tell you what I'm seeing right now. People are literally running in here, and the sound that you can hear behind me of shooting is celebratory gunfire. At one point, they actually fired an RPG into Gaddafi's house, setting it ablaze, and just... the smiles on their faces as they're running into this compound is really something to behold.
Lourdes Garcia Navarro of NPR there on August 23rd, just a couple of months ago, and now just 1 week back in the U.S. from Libya, sitting in the studio with us, looking back on that time with her husband, James Hyder, Middle East correspondent for the Times of London. We've got a lot of callers for you, too. Mary in Buffalo Gap, Virginia. Mary, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. Actually, I'd like to direct my question to Ms. Garcia Navarro. First of all, let me say I am absolutely in awe of your reporting. Every time you come on NPR, everything else in my life stops, and I'm just riveted to my radio.
We hear that, Mary. We hear that. Yes, please.
Thank you.
So my question is, when you are on task reporting in the thick of things and you see perhaps someone in trouble that you know you could help, but then you wouldn't be able to do your reporting. How do you stay objective and remain on task?
Lourdes.
That's a really good question. And I think when you're dealing in situations where, you're seeing life and death unfold in front of your eyes, it's something that's always present. But I always say when people ask me this that if you can't be a good human being and a good reporter, then I'd rather be a good human being than a good reporter. And I think both, they're not mutually exclusive. And so I think you always have to keep in mind, as a journalist, and I've been in many different situations. I've been embedded with the U.S. military. I've been in all sorts of various situations in combat, that you do tend to have a natural sympathy for the people that you're with who are fighting against someone else. And you need to tamp that down, and you need to look objectively around you about to see exactly what's going on. It is a struggle at times, but I really do think that you can be a good person and be a good reporter.
Did you have times when you had to choose in Libya?
Can
you remember a moment where it was like, okay, do I get the story or do I remain humane?
There's things I chose not to do, absolutely, things that I chose not to do so that I could maintain a journalistic distance. Part of that, for example, is not going in a gun truck with the rebels as they're taking somebody's life. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that is a particularly appropriate place for me to be. I think as a reporter, first of all, I want to be in a car that I can get away if I need to. And second of all, I think I need to be I need to have that distance.
Mary, why were you riveted when you heard Lourdes reports from Libya? What was it about those reports?
It was her phenomenal ability to put me right there beside her. So I wasn't just listening to news unfolding. I was in another country surrounded by a different culture, feeling, experiencing what she was reporting on. I'm absolutely in awe of you, Miss Garcia Navarro.
Thank you.
There you are. Mary, thank you so much for your call. Let me get one more right here. Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Jason. Jason, you're on the air.
How you doing? My question is for Lourdes. My question is, were you not allowed to report the plight of the blacks in Libya who were fighting with Gaddafi? I saw Russian Today, and they actually had a story where they're interviewing the blacks there who were actually being raped and slaughtered. Were you not able to? Were the rebels not allowing you to? I think you did a pretty good job, but I also think that not enough was reported on the supporters of Gaddafi. What are they doing right now? Are they okay? Are their life in danger or what?
Lourdes, what about this? I mean, some of us may have only a sort of distant view of this, but there were many claims and evidence on tape and so on, I guess, that there were mercenaries or supporters, call them what you will, brought in from sub-Saharan Africa to help Muammar Gaddafi. What about their role, their plight, as our caller, Jason, puts it?
A couple of things. I mean, I think very early on it was clear, and we reported on the fact that African community there that had come into work was being treated very badly, and that happened almost immediately.
There was all this reports of thugs in the streets and so on, but there were also just economic migrants who had been there before.
I did a story, for example, in the Western Mountains where I got to interview a lot of these guys, and it was a complicated picture. Mm-hmm. There were African mercenaries that did come in, but those were actually, I think, ultimately the minority. There's a huge African community there that had come in as migrant workers, and then as this unfolded, were co-opted because they lost their jobs, were then co-opted into Gaddafi's military force and were offered money, sometimes were press ganged into fighting for Gaddafi. So there's that group. And then there's, of course, a third group who didn't have anything to do with anything and were just trapped there. And we have seen that they have been treated extremely badly. Jason Bobian was actually focusing on this issue for NPR and did many stories on it. I was focusing on other stuff just after the fall of Tripoli. But we've seen this unfold. And it's not only, by the way, Africans from sub-Saharan Africa who treated badly, but you see, for example, how black Libyans from Tuarga have been treated extremely badly, and they have been terrorized.
A whole town kind of emptied there and killed?
chased away. I mean, they left before the Misratis actually took over the town. But what we've seen is people from Misrata actually hunting them down where they've been hiding, and terrorizing them effectively. So you are seeing an entire country turned on its head, and the innate, there's an innate sense of racism, I would say, there now. Absolutely.
James Hyder, let me ask you first on this front. Here's Lourdes reporting for National Public Radio and The Nation. NPR is the United States. Here you are with The Times of London, the UK. Is there a difference in perspective that you bring to, let's say, a question like this one? Who's fighting for whom? Who's supporting whom? Is there a different line of skepticism, challenge, attitude, outlook, inquiry that your nationality or your publication pushes or brings you to bring, or not?
I don't think so. I mean, I think there's the basic sort of, you know, rules of journalism. You go out there and, I mean, yeah, it's, I think, as Lulu said, you do have a certain sympathy with the people you're around. And of course,
in this case, the rebels, overwhelmingly.
But I mean, you also feel very sorry for the people who are being victimized because of what's happened. And a lot of them were victims of circumstance, as Lulu said, sort of people who were press-ganged into fighting, people who were confused. A lot of people just didn't know what was going on. I mean, it was a very closed society. And when Gaddafi went on the radio and said, these people you're fighting are Al-Qaeda, they're crusaders, a lot of people believed that. And they thought that they were fighting to the very end against Al-Qaeda until they were captured by the rebels. And they were like, wait, you're Libyans. What are you doing here? So there's a lot of confusion there.
Let me ask you another question on craft. Here you are in print. Lourdes is in radio. You can hear in her reports, in a way that you cannot in a newspaper story, her emotion. And we just heard it in the Gaddafi's compound as everybody's coming in, even if it's just tone of voice. Not that it's terribly emotional, but it's there. You're watching the kind of reporting she's doing as a print reporter. Do you envy that immediate conveyance of emotion that the voice brings to radio reporting versus news print reporting? Or, you know, do you prefer this sort of cooler medium, though it can be very moving, of print?
I mean, I think you get maybe more leeway as a print journalist because you can actually sort of write more depth, and you know, but you lose the immediacy that radio does. And yeah, I would love to be able to get that immediacy that you have. But on the other hand, I've seen Lulu working, and radio is a hell of a lot of work.
Why? Because you've got to get the microphone to
because
where the
bang-bang
is.
Because you've got to get the microphone to wherever everything is, and it's very difficult to catch up if you miss something. It's a bit like photography in that aspect. So it's definitely much more labor intensive, I think.
And Lourdes, what about you looking on it? Why?
Well, anyone who ever wants to come into radio, you know, I have a lot of my colleagues in print who love NPR and say, I'd love to do radio. It's so great what you do. And I'm always like, oh, no, it ain't.
Why?
Because if you're a print journalist, you can exactly, if you miss the moment, if I hadn't been at Babel Azizia compound at that moment,
your name would be mud.
My name would be mud. And I mean, the BBC missed it, for example, famously. And they had no one there, and it became like an enormous scandal. And you can't go back and sort of and recreate it as print.
So your very person, your body has to be there at that moment, so you can hear all that.
And I'm the interpreter of events for people. When people say, you know, I'm so glad that they say that because I am trying to bring you there. I am the person that I'm trying to explain to you what it feels like to be there at that moment. And sometimes you can get it wrong. For example, at Babel Azizia compound, you know, I said
Gaddafi's they have compound again in Tripoli, yeah.
In Tripoli's, you know, and I was like, oh, no, they have the run of the place. That's celebratory gunfire. Well, you know, actually the battle was still raging. I mean, most of it was celebratory, but there was a part of it that there was still, it was so chaotic.
So you have to report, you have to convey what you perceive in that moment, but it may be wrong. Print has time maybe to figure
exactly,
that out.
Exactly. And not, be, you know, and so. And
it wasn't
so,
too far wrong. The compound was
no, exactly. It wasn't wrong. Taken. But what it was, it was being taken. But what I'm saying is that, you know, ultimately, you know, you're reacting to circumstances around you and you imbue the moment with this sense of immediacy and you can see people's joy on their faces. And literally, as I was doing that, people were running at me with guns in their hands and it was this overwhelming moment, and there was still smoking debris, and it was just absolute chaos. And so you can lend that immediacy, but you know, I think with print, you do get that context afterwards.
And then, in the midst of all that, live in your ear is Robert Siegel sitting all the way back in Washington, via satellite, sort of coming down to you with a follow-on question.
I know. Somebody tweeted that day, the producer of that show tweeted, Lourdes Garcia Navarro just heard her say, oh, I'm sorry, excuse me, as gunfire erupted in her ear.
Wow. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about reporting the Arab Spring and where the region's historic political upheaval stands now, with NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro and James Hyder, Times of London Middle East correspondent. They have both been in the middle of it. They happen to be husband and wife in the middle of it. There were joyous times. There were gruesome times. There were strange moments. Here's Garcia-Navarro reporting from beside, next to the dead body of Colonel Muammar Gaddafi's corpse, October 23rd in Misrata.
So I'm inside the room where Muammar Gaddafi is being displayed to everyone. He's on a mattress covered in plastic with a dirty blanket. People are shouting, Allahu Akbar, God is great. Coming in here, the excitement is palpable, seeing the dead dictator.
Beside him is his son Mutasim and his defense minister, slain as well in equally murky circumstances. Among the gathered crowd, there is little pity or remorse at how Gaddafi met his violent end in what is increasingly seeming like a cold-blooded execution. Mahmoud Amin says he took a grim satisfaction in seeing Gaddafi's curly locks on his lifeless body.
Well, I don't feel sorry for him, you know. I don't feel sorry that we lost him. In fact, I think we paid the price. We have a lot of blood.
We have a lot of blood. The dead dictator there right beside Lourdes Garcia-Navarro, and it is a moment in history. It was being reported around the world, and yet it's you personally standing there. How do you, I mean, there's something ghoulish at the same time. There's a huge historic fact here.
Horrific, and I think you look at that, you look at it in two ways. Well, first of all, he's dead, and that provides a great deal of catharsis for people. And also, you know, in the Arab world, I think they wanted to, this ghoulish spectacle of people lining up for blocks and blocks, bringing their children into this
meat locker.
To see the corpse of Gaddafi, it strikes one as absolutely horrific. But in another sense, it did provide people with this certainty that they couldn't say, oh, this was a hoax. Oh, this was...
He's not going to pop up next week somewhere.
Exactly. This did provide people with a certainty. And many people said that to me, that they came to know that it was true. They didn't believe it until they saw it. This was a man who had loomed so large in their life for 42 years that they really wanted to see it. But of course, what ended up happening was that the spectacle that went on and on for days and days until the bodies were decomposing and the smells were horrific, is that it really made, I think, the rebels of Misrata, who had taken this body as a war trophy, essentially, not particularly, it didn't look well in the eyes of the world.
We've got all kinds of response here. James Hyder, Lourdes Garcia-Navarro. Here's from Kimberly on Twitter, asking, what was your impression of the rebels who dropped everything as doctors, lawyers, university students to fight for Libya? There's that kind of heroic, I mean, a question with a sort of heroic characterization within it. We'll come to that. But here's another from John online saying, I'm very skeptical of the Arab Spring. Egypt's going to be run either by the military or Islamists, as no other group is organized enough to fill the power vacuum. The Libyan rebels, John asserts, contain many Al-Qaeda sympathizers and members. The despots being deposed aren't any great loss to the world, but without a secular culture that does not exist in the Islamic world, democracy is going to be merely result in theocracy. Let's hold that assertion, those questions, and get a couple on the air here. Saad in Los Angeles, California. Saad, thanks very much for calling. You're on the air.
Yes, hi, Tom. Actually, my question is basically a follow-up to these observations. It is about the progression of the Arab Spring, and with your guests having first had an account of what is happening on the ground there, does it seem, and I want them to correct me if I'm wrong, does it seem that these revolutions seem to be gradually stolen from the liberal, moderate voices that usually spark these revolutions by more fundamentalist Islamist entities that seem to be sidelining these moderate voices?
Will it be, is it being stolen from the moderate, maybe liberals in the streets in the first place? Saad, thank you. James Hyder, what do you say?
I think Egypt's probably the best example of that. The revolutionaries on Tahrir Square were young, educated, English-speaking largely, and they, by their determination, pushed the whole thing through. They didn't run away in the face of Mubarak's thugs. And now the army high command has tried to hang on to power, partly through incompetence because they don't know how to run a country, partly through their vested interest of certain parts of the military council. It is a military junta at the moment.
But that's not theocracy moving in. That's, in a way, the vestiges of Mubarak's power structure still hanging on in the face of those secular, more secular-minded students.
Exactly. But the problem is that they want to push through elections fairly quickly, and the only organized opposition under Mubarak was the Muslim Brotherhood. So the revolutionaries, the young educated revolutionaries, are saying what we need is more time to organize to get our act together. But on the other hand, we don't want the military carrying on like this. We want a technical government. You know, we want a civilian government. And they are calling on Western governments like the US to actually put pressure on the Egyptian military command to step down, to allow a more sort of civilian technical government to take over.
Well, let's stick with Egypt for a moment. Lourdes, do you see then the Egyptian military, still with a lot of power there, finding it in its interest to support the more Islamist political elements within Egypt because they would somehow make alliance with them, as Mubarak did not?
Well, we've seen them. I mean, some people would say that we've seen them co-opt the Islamists there, portions of the Muslim Brotherhood. I mean, I think
am I interpreting before? I mean, I thought Mubarak always tried to
Mubarak did, but I'm saying the military.
More recently,
we've seen the military council. Mm-hmm. You know, some say that they've, you know, that some parts of the Islamists have been co-opted and are working with the military council. You know, it remains to be seen what's going to happen there. But I will say that what we're seeing in Egypt is definitely, I think, a template for other what we're seeing in other parts of the region. Tunisia, recently, the big winners were the Islamists. I think we're going to see that certainly in Libya. But what do we mean by Islamists? You know, we use that term as a blanket term, and it seems extremely scary to people in the West.
Our correspondent John wrote on the website, the Libyan rebels contain many Al-Qaeda sympathizers. That's one interpretation of Islamist.
That is one interpretation.
Is that factual?
Certainly, we have seen people who participated in the revolution who fought with, you know, in Afghanistan and Iraq. That there's no question of that. Famously, the head of the, you know, the head Belhaj in Tripoli, who's the head of the sort of military council in Tripoli, was also someone who's an Islamist and was, you know, rendered by the British government to Libya and was tortured. So basically, it's a confusing picture. There are a lot of different groups at the moment, but Islamists is not just one thing. It's not Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. There are moderate Islamists. It's of many, many different stripes. These are pious countries.
We read in Tunisia about, there were Islamists plurality, I guess, in that election, but they were still talking about, I don't know, allowing foreign tourists to wear bikinis on the beach. This is not exactly, I don't know, how, I mean, I'm being frivolous for a moment here, but just to say, this doesn't look like a blanket Iranian-style edict.
It isn't. Are so many. I think one of the interesting things that's happening here is that you're seeing a plurality of Islamists, and there are different factions between them, and many of them are in direct opposition to each other. You have some that are extremely orthodox and others that are more liberal. And so what's happening within the Islamist movement is actually very, very interesting, I think. And we're seeing that in Egypt. We're seeing that certainly in Libya.
And what about to Kimberly's question on Twitter of doctors, lawyers, and students who dropped everything to fight for Libya? What happens to them in this metamorphosis?
I was just talking about this. It's a double-edged sword. Amazing. One of the most amazing things is imagine yourself all of a sudden never having carried a gun. Libya wasn't a gun culture, actually, unlike Iraq and other places in the Middle East. And all of a sudden, they're fighting for their lives. But now you see 15-year-olds on the street wearing uniforms with guns. What's going to happen to these people? They've gotten a taste for everything that fighting in a rebellion means. Are these people going to go back to school?
The power of that gun and direct intimidation and all the rest.
And I think one of the gravest concerns, if you talk to ordinary Libyan citizens, is how are we going to get our children back and how are we going to get these weapons back?
Mark in Arlington, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom. And hello, Lourdes, if that's...
Yes.
I wanted to say that I have some serious concerns about the quality of the reporting in the mainstream media with regard to the Arab Spring.
Why?
We got a lot of stories about its leaders being bad guys, which in fact they are. They were. We also got no stories about the fact that the rebels were not necessarily the good guys that the media wanted us to think they were. One major example of this is the reporting on the attack on CBS reporter Lara Logan, who...
This was in Egypt during the Tahrir Square uprising where she was sexually assaulted.
She was brutally attacked. Mm-hmm. But in any of the stories in the mainstream media that I've read If they mention it at all, they wait until like paragraph 10, which nobody reads to mention that the fact that what sparked this was people in the crowd shouting that she was a Jew, which in fact she was not, but that's irrelevant. The fact that they thought she was a Jew was enough for hundreds of people to want to pile on at the opportunity to murder a Jew.
I actually do not know the facts of this, Mark. I don't know if that's, let me put it to my guests much closer than I, Mark James. I mean, to the broad suggestion here from our caller that there's kind of a cleaning up or a tidying up of what's going on there, or maybe sympathies coming into play to keep us from being told everything. And what about in the specific instance of Lara Logan? I don't know. Do you?
Well, from what I heard about Lara Logan was that she was actually, because on Tahrir Square that night there was a huge celebration. There was probably about a million people in that area.
Yeah.
And a lot of people who had nothing to do with the actual revolution were there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it has to be said, Egypt has a very bad record of sexual harassment. It's a very sort of oppressed society in that way.
Quite apart from anti-Semitism or Jewish, you name it. But
yeah,
what about that assertion that Mark
that is
making?
The first I've actually heard of them shouting out she was a Jew.
I mean, didn't know that. I hadn't heard that either. For me, it was violence against women. I was not egregiously assaulted as Lara was,
mm-hmm.
But I was also assaulted, and have been in Egypt. It's a very common culture. And I did a story actually after that happened, talking about how Egyptian women
kind of
suffered
pawed
and
groping
verbally
and all that.
groping. And there's been rapes and Egyptian women suffer from that. I don't think the Lara Logan incident got a little bit of attention. I think it got an inordinate amount of attention, and rightly so. And I think it shed a light on what women correspondents in the field go through and also what Egyptian women go through. And I don't think there was any tidying up of that. All these things can coexist. There can be moments of great joy, and you can see people who really fought for their country and are idealists. And also, these societies are complicated societies within a very, very difficult legacy. And how do they move on from that?
Mm.
Is it going to be the kind of tidy Western democracy? No. And I think one of the most interesting things is you see even the sort of secular, democratic, English-speaking Twitterati, as they're called,
mm-hmm.
of the Egyptian revolution. These are people who are now calling for an end with the peace treaty with Israel. These things are...
You unleash public opinion, and there it is. Caleb in Jamaica Plain, Massachusetts. Caleb, you're on the air.
Yes, thanks for having me on. I wanted to address what I see as a different kind of bias in mainstream reporting, which is a negligence to inform Western readers of what I see as the geopolitical context of NATO's involvement in the Libya affair. The actual composition of the transitional council there, which, by the way, was headed by the defense minister of the dictator in question. Another thing that is exceedingly absent from the reporting is the absolute hypocrisy and turnaround of most Western leaders who are related to Libya's oil exports, namely Tony Blair, who, after his press secretary denied that he had even consulted at all for the dictator. There's leaks of pictures showing his warm welcoming of his dear friend.
Caleb, if I may clarify, when you say geopolitical context is absent, Caleb, what are you really getting at there? Is this the NATO went in for the oil argument?
Say it once more.
Is this the NATO went in for the oil perspective?
Yes, NATO went in for the oil argument, and I think there's there were meetings between the Transitional National Council and NATO in regard to, and you'll see it, just look in back pages, come in the next coming year, privatization. That's the aim, that's the goal, and that's the reason why NATO is there, privatization.
Caleb, we've got it. Let me put it first to James Hyder. James, what about this? It's dressed up in, high-mindedness of protecting Libyan civilians and maybe standing up for toppling a dictator or bringing democracy, but Caleb, and there's this audience that sees it purely in much more skeptical terms. It's oil, it's hypocrisy, it's gain.
I'm sure there was an element of that to it. I mean, states aren't charities. They act in their own interest as much as anybody else. But I was in Benghazi just before NATO intervened, and the people of Benghazi were terrified, and they were crying out for NATO to intervene. to save them. And I think Benghazi would have fallen without NATO intervention. There would have been a massacre. There would have been mass arrests. People would have been tortured to death. And I think people tend to forget that. This is what the Libyans themselves wanted. When we first got to Benghazi, right after the revolution started, Libyans were saying, we don't need NATO, we can do it for ourselves. Mm-hmm. So they were very confident because they'd thrown over the troops there. And they were very confident they could do this. And when they saw they were going to be destroyed, we were being asked, why is NATO not here? Why don't you help us? So I think it was what the Libyans wanted, and the Libyans were fighting for that. And I'm sure probably there is some interest in getting the oil contracts. But on the other hand, I think it's worth reminding ourselves that the oil was on the market already. That's why people were trying to engage with Colonel Gaddafi years ago. So it wasn't that they were trying to sort of steal the oil. That was already out there on the market.
Lourdes, how do you think it is a big responsibility you carry as you're there in that moment in the field, whether it's at the Gaddafi compound or wherever you travel? And James, in that context, to both convey what you're seeing in front of your eyes at that very moment and to keep it in a context that lines up with a kind of greater reality. I mean, is that... You know, whether it's the political context, geopolitical context, all of that is there. You know, how do you carry that in the back of your mind as you're just looking out and directly reporting what you see?
Well, with great difficulty, and I think it is, a big burden. I would like to, speak to some of the reader's comments just because, mm-hmm. listener rather. I just think...
You just got a minute, so you know.
Okay, just briefly though, mm-hmm. I mean, I think that there is, obviously a wider context, and many of these former dictators were the creations and supported by mm-hmm. and engaged by the West. And I think that has been made extremely apparent, throughout this.
Well, Lourdes Garcia Navarro, we've heard the dust in your voice and the exertion in your reporting and been moved by it. James Hyder, we picture you there right alongside pouring out the text for the Times of London. We're grateful to the two of you for your work and for being with us today. Thank you very much for being with us, and good luck to you as you go back to your assignments.
Thank you.
Thanks to you both. Listeners, I'm taking care of a little creaky joint in the next couple of days. We'll be out for actually a couple weeks recovering from that. Not a biggie. I'll see you again soon. But thanks for tuning in today. Back with you before you know it. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.